In each of these stands, we've established a transect consisting of three plots, each a tenth of a hectare or quarter acre in size. And we've been looking at this across a moisture gradient and also an ash species gradient consisting of white ash on xeric upland sites to green ash on riparian sites and black ash in the more swampy and seasonally flooded lowlands. And I just want to point out this rating scale because I'm going to show some data based on this in terms of how we're quantifying ash decline and mortality on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being no evidence of decline and 5 being a dead tree. This is some work that some graduate students and postdocs have done. Ann Marie Smith, a graduate student, Kamal Gandhi, a postdoc, have been looking at patterns of mortality and decline. And what you see is initially black ash was declining a little bit faster than green and white. And after a couple years, all three species are declining about the same speed. But their average tree is about right here, which corresponds with the average ash tree in these forests being a little bit closer to this than to this. So the trees are declining quite rapidly. Mortality is extremely comprehensive and efficient. We found no relationship, Annie found no relationship between density of ash and decline, and this line continues to elevate. You'll see some more data on that in just a second. Looking at ash density across a fairly wide range, we're seeing no relationship with ash density and EAB. We have data that directly relates this pattern of decline to emerald ash borer infestations as well. No relationship to any of these other variables either. Basal area, relative dominance of ash, density of ash, stand density, stand basal area, no any measure of species diversity. So this really suggests that there's very limited potential for silvicultural options to prevent infestation or invasion and to limit mortality once invasion begins. In fact, the only pattern that we've been able to document is that relationship between percent mortality of ash and distance from the putative epicenter, which I think Nate Siegert's work has pretty much nailed down in Canton Township, Michigan. And so the farther that you move away from the epicenter where EAB initially established, the lower the mortality, a slope of about 2% per kilometer. With each kilometer that you move away, mortality drops 2%. This was in 04 and 05. Looking at Kamal Gandhi revisited Annie's plots in 2006 and found that the pattern stays the same, a 2% drop with each kilometer, but the intercept has jumped up about 30%, a 30% increase in mortality from 1 year to the next. And when Kamal went back in 07, we see now that the slope is no longer significant as the plots are basically all converging on 100% mortality. And this is everything from 1 inch that we're looking at, 1 inch DBH trees up, 100% mortality, extremely efficient killer of these ash trees. So now we're starting to turn our attention to the effects of all these gaps and ecological impacts. And Kamal talked this morning about some of the work she's doing on ground beetles in these gaps, and she's documenting some interesting patterns. We started to look at invasive plants in these gaps and the idea that EAB can facilitate the spread and establishment of invasive plants. So doing that, working with my wife, first grant that we've got together after 12 years of marriage, we're finally solidified as a couple enough to collaborate. Looking at successional trajectories, what we see is in our plots, which were selected because they contain ash, ash is the most common species in the understory. It's also the most common species in the seedling layer. Oak is very common in the overstory, but not in the understory. The most common species in the understory are elm, American and red elm, and maple, red maple, and silver maple in some of the black ash stands. So these stands are going to be converted. The great forest ecologist Bert Barnes published an interesting paper back in the late 1960s looking at the effects of Dutch elm disease when it came through these very same forests in southeast Michigan. And he was he noted that ash was going to be a major beneficiary of Dutch elm disease. And he was very prophetic, and he said, wrote in the discussion of this paper, until a major disturbance comes through and impacts the ash trees. Seedling data, ash is by far the most common seedling. And so this suggests that there's going to be some regeneration and that trees are going to be responding to these gaps and reaching the size that they can become infested. And then the question is, will EAB have died out? Will it come back in and infest these trees? And what impact will these small trees have on population dynamics? These little saplings produce two or three females and they die compared to the thousands of females produced by the large DBH trees. We've also been looking at seed bank dynamics, a collaborative project with Deb McCall and her group at Michigan State. And over the last 3 years, I think we've taken over 700 soil samples, and the number of ash seeds we've found is in the single digits. There is no ash seed bank. There are no dormant ash seeds. The seeds disappear very quickly. So, we're seeing seedlings that are present, saplings that are present. We're about ready to publish a paper that says, dead ash trees produce no seeds. Why are North American ash trees being devastated by a secondary pest, by a buprestid? This is an interesting question that we've been working on as well. And a study that my predecessor at Ohio State, Dave Nielsen, conducted with Franz Birchbohr foretold, I think, the demise of ash. And he established a common garden study at Worcester with seven species of birch trees, highly replicated, three North American species, and bronze birch borer is an endemic North American species. These species have an evolutionary history. These Eurasian species do not. And the results were pretty convincing. The four European and Asian species were overwhelmed and killed. Massive amount of bronze birch borer, huge outbreak, all kinds of beetles flying around in these plots, a major drought in 1988, yet very high survival of the North American species. And so one might conclude from that, where you have no evolutionary history, no resistance, at least a hypothesis. And if bronze birch borer were to be introduced to Europe, it would be added to the great phylloxerin that Bill Mattson talked about as a second devastating insect pest in Europe. And so they probably hope that they don't get this one. Our research program then, we started in 2003. As soon as we realized this was a buprestid, we figured it was probably the same story in reverse, and that the North American species had no inherent resistance, but we started a research program with these objectives: to identify resistant germplasm in a common garden study, the idea that Asian trees with an evolutionary history are probably resistant, since the pest insect is not a pest in Asia, working on trying to identify biochemical mechanisms of resistance and resistance genes and markers. Justin Whitehill, PhD student with Enrico Bonello in plant pathology, Ohio State, working on that with Jennifer Cook with the U.S. Forest Service, working with Enrico Bonello and Don Cipollini on the biochemistry, chemical ecology, Eric Rebeck, a postdoc with Dave Smitley at Michigan State on the Common Garden study, and Jennifer Cook with the Forest Service has started work on hybridization studies between North American and Asian ashes, with the idea to duplicate some of the successes in the chestnut blight breeding program based on hybridization and backcrossing. So we established this common garden study in 2003, the spring of 2003, just soon after EAB was discovered, with green ash, white ash, Manchurian ash, which has an evolutionary history, and then this hybrid that exists in the nursery industry between North American black ash and Asian Manchurian ash. And the results were pretty much as we suspected they would be: very high survival of Manchurian ash, a little bit of colonization and mortality in the first year, perhaps while the trees were undergoing transplanting stress, no mortality and a little bit of colonization since then, but pretty much 100% mortality, and now it is 100% of the green ash, and also surprisingly the hybrid. But Jennifer Cook, the geneticist with the Forest Service, tells me she's very skeptical this is a true hybrid, and that it's really a black ash, and that the pollen donor Manchurian ash may represent or may have been contaminated with black ash pollen. Anyway, so the pattern consistent with what we saw with birch. Here's a Manchurian ash surrounded by North American trees. We've started working on resistance mechanisms, which are not very well understood in deciduous trees to wood borers. But the literature would speculate that this wound-induced periderm or callus tissue is involved in response to larval feeding, and also these induction of phenolics in response to feeding in the phloem tissue may synergistically interact this chemical and physical induced response. So we're kind of looking at that. This is Don Cipollini injecting a tree with some elicitors. We're looking at induced responses in the phloem tissue. This is a phenolic profile of the constitutive phloem chemistry of white and green ash. We also are white and Manchurian ash. The red trace is Manchurian ash, and there's a class of phenolic compounds, hydroxycoumarins, present in Manchurian ash that are not present in green ash or white ash. These compounds have been identified, and we've published here. Alita Isles, a postdoc, did this work, and we don't know that these are involved in resistance, but surely this is the most distinctive difference we've identified so far, and we're trying to follow that up with bioassays in artificial diets extractions. We've expanded the common garden to include a number of other species, European and other Asian species with the evolutionary history, Fraxinus chinensis, and some European species to kind of get a wider biogeographic range. And we've also started some studies to look at stress effects on resistance, with our prediction being that stress will matter to Manchurian ash, that stress will predispose Manchurian ash to colonization by EAB. But stress won't matter to the North American ash trees since they don't have any resistance to begin with, or it will matter less. So to conclude, what we're seeing is 100% ash mortality in all size classes, and it's just a matter of time before the other plots go to 100%. We see little potential for silvicultural management based on the relationships or lack thereof that we've discovered. We see no seed bank for ash, so the future of ash in southeast Michigan anyway, and probably beyond as it continues to spread, seems extremely perilous. The wild card would be the parasitoids that have been released by APHIS and the Forest Service. Widespread mortality and gap formation we're already seeing are starting to have some pervasive ecological impacts, and we're starting to look at some other things there. Manchurian ash is a source of resistance genes, and host plant resistance in support of breeding. A breeding program is now underway. I'd like to acknowledge the funding sources, in particular the U.S. Forest Service Northern Research Station and APHIS and the ARS, who have funded this work. And also, I'd like to acknowledge students, postdocs, lab group, and collaborators that have been involved in this work with me. And with that, I'll answer any questions if I have time. I'm sorry, lack of appearance?
Lack of apparency as a resistance characteristic.
So the question was, do we see any evidence of lack of apparency as a resistance mechanism? And no, I don't. Even in these very, where ash is in very low density, they're finding them and killing the trees.
I meant in Manchuria. In
the common garden, this lack of man. Well, that's kind of an interesting idea. In our common garden, the trees are planted in, you know, pretty close proximity, and we see them feeding on the foliage, you know, and landing on the trees and so forth. So, but that, you know, that's an interesting idea, I guess. I guess the idea would be that there had been selection to reduce oviposition. Pardon me?
Want to hide.
Yeah, I can't really answer the question. It's interesting, but I can't answer it.
The idea of the co-evolved relationship between the host plants and the beetle, why would the mechanisms that the native trees have for native borers not work against the introduced borer?
All right, so the question is, why would mechanisms of resistance that North American ashes have not work against emerald ash borer? And One would be that they just lack these specific targeted defenses that are toxic to emerald ash borer. Another major point is that the native borers are cerambycids. The most important ones are cerambycids and cicadas that are feeding in the sapwood and heartwood. And you don't have a major phloem borer. The buprestids of ash are more twig borers and canopy things. So it's kind of this phloem feeding on the main trunk is kind of a vacant niche that emerald ash borer has exploited.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kind of a melodramatic title there, ecological tragedy, but I think as we go through this, you'll see that it really has the potential to be one. So Bud wanted to start off with acknowledgments, and I think the point here is that this is a presentation that Bud has synthesized a lot of information from various researchers in the Forest Service, especially Steve Frederick and Jim Hanula. We'll see their data as we go through this, as well as some of the state people there, Bud in Florida, South Carolina, Georgia. So a lot of people have been involved in this project. And also sort of an introduction, but I think it's kind of a summary here. So after this slide, we get the acknowledgments and the summary, so I'll wake up in about 20 minutes and we'll be done. But as a way of introduction, laurel wilt is a new disease. It's really devastating the red bay tree in the southeastern United States. It's caused by a new fungus or a new species of Rafflesia that is vectored by this ambrosia beetle. And not only affects red bay, but it has the potential to affect other Lauraceae. And it's rapidly spreading through the southeast, and there's concern about what it might do when it gets into the Lauraceae and the Americas. So we'll go through each of those points here. A little bit of background about what red bay is. I guess the saying goes that any good cook in the southeast who makes gumbo puts red bay in it, or bay leaves from red bay trees. So it has its ecological and economic uses up there. It's in Lauraceae, as it says, evergreen in the southeastern coastal plain. You see the map, maybe you can see the map in the lower right corner there. It does have some ecological roles as far as wildlife, the fruits for wildlife, and it is the only known host of the Palmetes swallowtail. As far as the beetle goes, it's kind of your typical Xyliberine ambrosia beetle, the skewed sex ratio, the polygyny, feeding on ambrosia fungus, which is key to this whole discussion, and one of the many exotics that have come into this country. It's from southeastern Asia, the countries you see there. What's a little bit atypical about this, though, is that it has somewhat of a restricted host range. As it says there, it's in Lauraceae in Asia, a few other host families, although in North America we've only seen it in Lauraceae, and I'm not quite sure about some of those other hosts. I think the host, the Lithocarpus, comes from Japan records. I think those other ones are from mostly from India, Bangladesh. So most ambrosia beetles, Xyliberine ambrosia beetles, have a very wide host range. This one may not. A little bit of history of it. We found the first Xyliberis glabratus beetles in EDRR, or Early Detection Rapid Response, traps in 2002 outside of Savannah, Georgia. We found maybe about five or so beetles in traps, and then with Forest Service and APHIS help, we looked around the Savannah area, put a bunch of traps up, and never found any more beetles in 2002. And we thought, well, maybe just the first beetles came out of the warehouse and that was it. They came to ethanol and alpha-pinene plus ethanol baited traps, funnel traps, and most ambrosia beetles, Xyliberine ambrosia beetles, would be attracted to those lures. So we didn't find any more when we did some hunting around there. In 2003, they started reporting mortality of red bay trees not too far from Savannah, in Hilton Head area especially. And then in 2004, Steve Frederick sent me some infested bolts, or beetles that he got from infested bolts of red bay in Hilton Head, and I figured it'd be the usual suspects of native and non-native species that are established, but it turns out they were all, almost all, Xyliberis glabratus. So that's when we started putting two and two together, I guess, and we saw that there were these red bay trees dying, and always associated with that were the Xylobius glabratus. Shortly after that, then, they started to do these host testing with the Raffaella species, and consistently isolated that species, which was a new species, from the sapwood, this discolored sapwood. I'll show you some pictures of the streaking, very striking. In 2005-2006, they continued to find it in the southeast, and found it in South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. And consistently, again, the fungus was always isolated from these dying trees. In 2007, we held a symposium with various groups to sort of address this problem. Here's the distribution map. The initial detection is up there near Port Wentworth, near Savannah, and the first few counties in 2004 were right around there, and then 2005 we started looking a little bit more, and we saw it in a bunch more counties in South Carolina, Georgia, as well as around Jacksonville, Florida. A little bit more concerted effort, and we found it in 2006 in a lot of places. In 2007, you see, 2006, I don't know if you can see down at the bottom there, but there was a sort of an isolated infestation in Indian River County, and in 2007, they found another one down there. So they're thinking that's probably firewood along the intercoastal waterway, because they like to, I guess some of the boaters like to use Red Bay for firewood around there. So that's what the thought is there. So it's probably not spreading that quickly since 2002. I think a lot of that is initial finds, but we'll continue to do surveys to figure out what it is, where it's going rather. So a little bit about the pathogen. What's unique here is that this is the fungal, the ambrosial fungal associate of the beetle. Most of the time, or I don't think any, maybe one other case, has this fungal association between the beetle and pathogenicity. It usually is not very pathogenic. It's an asexual anamorph stage of an ophiostoma, that's Raffaellia, and consistently isolated from these dying trees. And Steve Frederick's lab also did some isolations from the heads of the beetles, and found that, as is typical of Xylobius, the mycangia, where these spores are located, are on the base of the mandibles, paired mandibular mycangia. And what's pretty unique, and you'll see in one of these pictures too later, is the fungus is very pathogenic. You get one or two beetle hits when where the beetle is just feeding in the tree, and the fungus gets established there, and it'll kill the tree pretty quickly. In fact, there on the lower left, you see one beetle hit. That might not have even been a successful breeding attack. The beetle just bored in there. It was a healthy tree. The tree might have been too healthy for the beetle to survive and to breed in, but the fungus got established, and then soon, not too long after that, you start seeing the wilting, and that tree dies, very much like the Dutch elm disease scenario, where the beetle feeds on it, transmits the fungus, then the next beetles come along later on when that tree's dead and breed in it. So, as it says there, the beetles happen to hit a healthy tree, maybe testing it, and they infect the tree. Trees go down pretty quickly. This is from September to May. You see the tree on the left there looking fairly healthy, and then on the right, just several months later, that tree is pretty much gone. At this point, the tree does not have beetles attacking it for breeding purposes. These are, I think, really good pictures showing the streaking of the fungal caused by the fungus. This is, again, before the beetle attacks the tree for breeding purposes. There may have been just a couple of beetle hits, either up or down the tree, but the fungus then spread throughout that tree, and that tree is just about dead, and then the beetles start to attack it. You see these are all beetle attacks there, those frass tubes, which I always thought was typical of Xylosandrus, but apparently it's also found in at least this species of Xylobius. So those are all beetle Xylobius glabratus attack points, the beetles kicking out the frass, and this is, again, several months after that tree exhibited that streaking. So that tree is obviously dead. The impacts, some of these areas, I don't think people realized how prevalent red bay is in these coastal forests, but when you start seeing all these dead trees, it's pretty impressive. So the impacts have been pretty great there. There are some areas that in 2, 3, 5 years, all of the red bays are just about dead, especially the ones that are greater than 1 inch in diameter. Shade trees in residential areas, those are dying just as well as the ones that are in the forested areas. So quite a costly impact to the neighborhoods, again, on the scale of emerald ash borer and Dutch elm disease from years ago. This is a study that Bud did in an island off the coast of Jacksonville, where he came in when they first started to notice red bay dying. They had maybe about the dotted line there is all of the trees size classes, and so I guess when he first got in there, there was about 10% mortality in July of 2005. By January of 2007, so a year and a half, he had about 92% mortality of all size classes, and you see the bigger size classes on the top side of the graph there going out first pretty quickly. So some of those trees were probably dying when he first got in there, but I think it's pretty impressive that the mortality swept through these areas so quickly. And this is typical of what was seen on lots of coastal islands up and down from Charleston, South Carolina to Jacksonville. We were on Hilton Head and Hunting Island, and you'd see just 80-90% mortality when you talk to the people there that said, we didn't see any of this just 2-3 years ago. So very quick, very impressive. Host susceptibility. The beetle and the fungus have been recovered, of course, from red bay, as well as sassafras, which is also Lauraceae, as well as avocado, which is also in the same genus as red bay. The fungus only, but not the beetle, has been found from a few other species, all Lauraceae, pond spice, pond berry, and camphor tree. As I said, the fungus, but not the beetle. The beetle's probably been in there, but it's just very hard to find in these small trees, or some of those pond berry, pond spice, are almost shrub-like, bush-like trees. So there is possibility that other species may be vectoring this. There is some indication that Xyloborhynchus saccessinae may pick up the fungus, but they're still looking into that. Jim Hanuel and Steve Frederick are looking at that. But that's the only beetle that seems to be picking it up. But it's basically vectored by Xyloborhynchus scabratus. Some inoculation studies that Steve Frederick has done in lab. He's tested various species of Lauraceae, red bay, sassafras, avocado, the spice bush, as well as California bay laurel, and wilt symptoms were produced in each of those species.